All right, so we're going to take up the second part of the Hakdamah LePerek HaChelek, which again, in our series of introductions, this is a little bit of a different type of introduction because this introduction is not an introduction to a sefer, rather, and it's not an introduction to like a section, it's an introduction to a perek. And not only is it a strange introduction, it's really one of the most important philosophical works by the Rambam. In many ways, you can argue second to the Mor Nevuchim. And its most famous aspect, which we're going to probably spend most of the time on today, are the Yud Gimel Ikarim. But before we get to Yud Gimel Ikarim, let's do a quick chazara from where we left off. And we left off where the Rambam had basically introduced us to two types of pleasures. Okay, the first type of pleasure are physical pleasures. Those are exclusive to the domain of earth. And you derive them through the experiential. He did mention the idea of things like kavod, of desiring honor, as not really rooted in something physical, but putting those to the side in general, he's referring to things like eating and sexual relations. These are things that are physical pleasures, and they're exclusive to earth. The person enjoys them, but they're nothing like the what he calls spiritual pleasures, which are exclusive to Olam Haba, to the world to come. It is impossible for a human being in this world to ever perceive that or experience that type of pleasure. Okay, now that doesn't mean when a person is engaged in, let's say, learning, whatever, like using as an example, learning, that there isn't some sort of intellectual enjoyment a person has, but it's still not the same thing. It's not comparable to spiritual pleasures. The pleasures that a person gets in Olam Haba are both eternal, which is critical. In other words, even when a person eats, when a person learns, whatever it might be, those are temporal. Whereas in the world to come, the tanug is eternal. And the other thing is that the pleasure there is superior. And we'll try to get a sense of why that's the case as we understand how Olam Haba works. And you're also going to get a sense of the Rambam's overarching approach, in many ways to Judaism, that you'll see in his idea of the world to come. So here we go. Here comes the Rambam's idea of the world to come. As a caveat, a few people mentioned to me after last week's, discussion, how, like, they didn't know about this. Like, is this true? Like, we never learned about this before. It is kind of shocking to me that when the idea of the world to come is discussed, in general, details aren't usually presented in most, I think, most high schools, yeshivot also, they kind of avoid it. And if they don't avoid it, they will talk most probably about the Ramban's type of approach, which is very physical or messianic. And the Rambam's approach is kind of, I don't know if anyone ever talks about it, which is shocking because, well, I shouldn't say it's shocking. There's something about the Rambam's approach that, like I always like to say, has a certain elegant simplicity to it, but it's certainly not emotionally appealing. And I think that's the thing that people have the hardest time with when it comes to the Rambam's idea of the world to come. So let's just, if you recall the various groups that the Rambam was talking about who were speculating about what the good is, if you recall, there was the physical Gan Eden, physical Gehenim group. That was group one. Then you had the Messianic era group. You had the immortality group, which was resurrection of the dead, and you had the whatever's written in the Torah, that's the good. All right, so we're going to come back to those as the Rambam presents the world to come. Now he's going to tell you what his idea of the good is. So he says, in the world to come, our souls will become wise out of the knowledge of God the Creator. Now, before we get to the mechanics, it shouldn't surprise you to see that the Rambam's focus on the Olam Haba is going to be about the intellect, about knowing, about yediyah, knowledge of God, because the Rambam held that the objective of a human being in his life is to try and know God. That is the objective. So the greatest state of existence that a human being could ever have is to be in the state that all you are doing is knowing God. So again, if on earth our objective is to try and know God, which we'll get into later on why it's impossible to know God, but that's our objective, and yet that ability is always going to be hampered by the fact that we're physical creatures and temporal pleasure, etc. Imagine an existence where all you're doing is knowing God. Now, if I took it out of saying knowing God and replaced that with X, meaning, in other words, forget if knowing God is something you want to do. The idea is that whatever the objective of human beings are in this world, right, you achieve the ultimate state of existence in Olam Haba, right? It just happens to be, according to the Rambam, that the ultimate state of existence will be you understanding God. But here's the difficult part, okay? The only thing you'll be doing, and the way I describe this when I teach this is almost like a tunnel. Imagine you're in a tunnel and there's nowhere else to go other than straight. And you see, apologize for the terminology, a light at the end of the tunnel. All you're doing is you're in that activity, that tunnel, that's all you do. You're just focused on God and understanding Him, okay? But that means there are no physical enjoyments, okay? There's no eating, drinking, no sexual enjoyment. None of those physical enjoyments exist. No honor, nothing. Not only that, all right, the Rambam doesn't say this openly, but this is extrapolated from what he says. There's no memories, right? Because all you're doing is you're actively knowing God, right? So whatever that means, right, it's to the exclusion of everything else. There's no psyche, okay? No emotions, no happiness or joy, no laughter or crying. None of those things exist. No ego. None of it exists in Olam Haba because all you're doing is knowing God, okay? So again, if we say that the greatest state of existence is to be engaged in Yediyat Hashem, and that will take place in Olam Haba without any cessation, it's eternal, and that's the greatest pleasure, that's to the exclusion of everything else. So you're not going to see your family. There's going to be no, wonderful food. All those fantasies that people have, the Rambam would say doesn't exist. Okay. And again, the ultimate good pleasure is to experience knowing God forever. There's no greater state for human existence than to be in Olam Haba. Okay. That is, in a nutshell, that is the Rambam's idea of Olam Haba. Now, of course, what about the punishment? Remember, the Rambam's trying to find out not just what the good is, but what's evil. All right. So what's the worst punishment? Basically, what he calls kares, okay? It's the cutting off the soul so that it perishes and does not live eternally. So we have to be careful, okay? What the Rambam is saying is that what's punishment, all right? Punishment isn't, let me put it this way, all right? So the Rambam would agree that there are different levels, okay, that a person can achieve in Olam Haba. Now, when I say levels, that doesn't mean that you're assigned level 46 and the other person's assigned level 47. Rather, it means depending on how good of a person you've been, how perfected, etc., will determine the level of knowledge you'll have of God, right? So we can certainly say that Moshe Rabbeinu is on this curve, is at the highest level, okay? And everyone else is somewhere below, right? But we can say Moshe's on the highest level. Problem is, when it comes to punishment, it doesn't work that way. By punishment, it's very simple. Once you cross a certain threshold, you just cease to exist. Meaning, what happens? The greatest pleasure you could ever have is to be engaged in knowing God, even if, right, it's the most, or I should say the minimal level of knowing God. It's still the greatest pleasure. Someone who gets kare, someone who's the cessation of existence means it's the worst punishment because you're never going to have the opportunity to live to really experience what it means to be a human at the highest possible level. So according to the Rambam, the ultimate punishment is to simply get cut off, to never experience Olam Haba. Now, again, where this becomes challenging is that on the surface, okay, using the last thing I put down there as a serial killer, what becomes the difference between a person who murders one person, a serial killer, a pedophile, and Hitler? Because at the end of the day, from a kare standpoint, it doesn't really matter. I'm assuming all those people get kares. It doesn't matter. Meaning that, let's assume the threshold, just to be hypothetical, let's assume the threshold to get kares is murdering three kids, okay? So that means that once I hit that threshold, hey, I could kill 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. It won't make a difference because I'm getting kares. So one of the famous issues that people take up with the Rambam is that how does the scale work punishment-wise? Meaning we can understand positive-wise how, depending on the level you're on, will determine the level that you'll understand God. But insofar as kares is concerned, there isn't being more cut off. Either you're cut off or you're not cut off. So on this, one of the challenges in the Rambam is to understand how do you differentiate punishment so far as evil people are concerned. Not to mention also, I was being a little slightly facetious. The Rambam doesn't even talk about serial killers or Hitlers. He talks about people who deny truth, people who are heretics. He's worried more about those people who philosophically are corrupt. Those are the ones who he says get kares. So again, you get into the question of what exactly is the line, is the threshold for philosophical corruption. And if whatever that line is, let's say it means, I don't know, believing the Torah is not divine in origin, why stop there? Then the person, once he hits that threshold, can keep going and deny God exists at all. So that's the Rambam's, the other side of the coin to Olam Haba. Okay? Now the Rambam has to go back now, and he doesn't, in other words, he doesn't discount the original groups entirely because they have reasonable arguments. So his job, he's putting on his lawyer hat now. His job is to now explain, well, what about the fact, for example, that the Torah says, if you do the mitzvot, this is what's going to happen. If you do sins, this is what's going to happen. What about group 4? What do we do about them? How do we understand why the Torah tells us reward and punishment? So he explains as follows. He says, the Torah lays out the system of rewards and punishments, seemingly pointing towards the good slash evil. Okay, but he explains, no. What's the Torah talking about? It's a very interesting idea. What he says is that the Torah is telling you that if you follow the Torah, all right, so we know living on earth, right, there are certain, let's say, let's use a simple example. Let's say a person needs to eat. So what does a person have to do? A person has to plant seeds and plow and this and that and harvest and make his bread, blah, 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 blah. There's a lot of steps involved. It takes time, energy, etc. And the person also follows the Torah. So what's God going to do? God's going to make that the life of that person easier. Somehow the physical world will operate in a manner where there's fewer obstacles that are in place so that person can spend more time serving God. So for example, let's say the soil becomes more bountiful, or the harvest becomes more bountiful, or somehow a new method to grind wheat comes into existence. The point is that God will remove those obstacles. And the example he gives is, one example is, let's say war, okay? If Chas V'Shalom B'nai Yisrael in a state of war, so following the Torah becomes much more challenging. We have to worry about sending our young men and women into battle, right? But what's the solution? If we follow the Torah, there'll be no more war. No more war is there, so therefore we can serve God better. So the Rambam, when he learns the brachos and klalos in the Torah, so what that means is that, well, the brachos at least, we'll get to the klalos right now, the brachos mean that what's God going to do? God's going to ensure the physical world, rather than present itself as an obstacle, it really works in line with man's service of God. It only help him serve God. Now he says, now what about the klalos? Okay, so let's say we don't follow the Torah and we're sinning. So then this is very interesting. God will go ahead and create obstacles that prevent us from following the Torah. Okay, meaning that let's say things are good, again, going back to let's say we'll use war as an example. There's no war. There's been peace for 50 years. And we stop following the Torah, then what God will do is he'll create war, which God is aware will prevent us from actually following the Torah. It's as if God is saying, I'm going to make the idea of doing tshuva, the challenge of tshuva, even more difficult, which is a very strange idea when it comes to understanding Onesh. We would think Onesh is an opportunity for us to do tshuva, okay? Ultimately, what the Rambam is saying is that God will create a situation that prevents us from ever achieving Olam Haba. So if we understand Olam Haba as the ultimate good, the point he's trying to get across is that we'll never shy away from the mitzvos. We'll avoid sins as much as possible because we know the potential for Olam Haba will be lost. Now, what about Gan Eden and Gehenna? Remember group one. Group one is using Gemara. Obviously the Torah mentions Gan Eden too, but I'm saying there's tons of Gemaras, which the Ramban, when he attacks the Rambam, uses this as a proof. There are tons of Gemaras that talk about Gan Eden and Gehenna. So what does the Rambam do about that? Now, this is probably one of the oddest, maneuvers the Rambam pulls off in this section, where he says as follows. He says, what is Gan Eden and what's Gehenna? So he says, Gan Eden is actually a hidden place on earth, filled with incredible physical things. So for those people who think that we finished our cartography, we know the entire, we have Google Earth, we know where everything is on earth. According to the Rambam, Gan Eden refers to some hidden place somewhere, some paradise that we haven't located yet, where that place is reserved for tzaddikim, and it's filled with incredible things. It's like a physical paradise. One day, we'll know where it is, but for now, it's hidden away somewhere on earth. That's Gan Eden. It doesn't really explain why that would be the case or what its purpose is. He just kind of just literally skips over that point. Whereas when it comes to Gehenna, okay, now this is interesting too. He says, quote, it refers to the pain and punishment which will come upon the wicked. Now, that's interesting because it's always unclear what he's referring to here. Is he referring to some idea about kares, meaning is it possible that if a person's evil before they die and ultimately get kares, that there's some punishment they experience and then they get kares? Or is he referring to earthly pain and punishment that happens in the physical world? It's unclear. But the point is that the Rambam, and Gehenna isn't as much of a challenge, but the point is when it comes to Gan Eden, it's almost shocking that the Rambam takes the idea of Gan Eden and actually says it's a place on earth. It's just somewhere we don't know where it's located. It's hard to understand how that would work today, but that's how the Rambam deals with that issue. Now, what about Tchiyas HaMeisim? Now, Tchiyas HaMeisim also presents a very difficult problem for the Rambam's position. Why is Tchiyas HaMeisim such a challenge? Well, the Rambam established clearly that the greatest state of existence for a person to be in is an Olam Haba. But here's the problem, though. The problem is that God also said There's going to be a resurrection of the dead. Now, in order to be resurrected, if you are dead, you need to be plucked out of Olam Haba, so to speak, and put back on earth. But here's the problem. Who would ever want that? Who would ever want to be resurrected? Because that's like saying you're in, again, the analogy I sometimes use with my kids. Imagine Olam Haba is like Disney World, okay? And you're on Space Mountain and you're having the time of your life. You don't want to go to like Knott's Berry Farm or some state fair. That's like a big step down. Who would want that? So the very idea, the Rambam has to struggle with the idea of Tchias HaMesim being an Iker. So one thing he explains is that it's not for everybody. Not everybody gets Tchias HaMesim. They couldn't because Tchias HaMesim, because Olam Haba is the greatest state of existence for a person. So he says instead Tchias HaMesim is reserved for a very few people. It doesn't say how many. Very few people get it. Tzadikim. And it's really the people who need to come back to help rebuild society. So when we hit the Messianic era, the utopian era of Judaism, so we're going to need a few people, a few of the old school to come in and teach us and help us. And for them, you could argue that might even be a step down in their existence because they have to leave Olam Haba. But for everyone else, 99.9% of Jews, we're not coming back from the dead. Once you hit Olam Haba, you're going to stay there eternally. So the Rambam has, to be clear, Sajagon, right? Remember, Sajagon precedes the Rambam. He didn't buy into this idea. Sajagon held that every Jew gets Tchias HaMesim. Much different idea. The Rambam holds Tchias HaMesim is reserved for a very, very small percentage of the Jewish population. Because you don't want to leave Olam Haba. Who would ever want to leave, understanding God 24/7, okay? Because returning to earth stinks in comparison. You never would want to do something like that. So that's how he responds to that group. And finally, you have the Messianic era group. What about this group? Okay. So he says, basically, the Rambam also has a very natural, which is consistent with his whole overall approach, is a very natural idea of Yemos HaMashiach. Whereas the Ramban, and even Sajagon to some extent, certainly the Ramban, maintained that Yemos HaMashiach is an era of what it called, of the highest peak of Jewish existence, of humanity, and that the laws of nature will change, and people will live forever. The Rambam basically says, nope, Messianic era is like the golden age of Judaism, okay? It's like Jews at their peak of power, all right? And that means you're going to have, you're going to have the king is universally recognized, and Jews will return to Israel, but there's no altering the laws of nature. And the fact is that he doesn't acknowledge that life will be easier. All will merit the world to come. The Mashiach will die, okay? His heir will take over. And the Rambam in here says his reign lasts thousands of years. In the Yad, he actually says it could even be shorter. The point is that it's an era that can come to an end. The Messianic era is not an endless period of time. It actually is something that the Rambam held can naturally come to an end, okay? Which is also a very different idea than most other medieval Jewish theologians. However, he does say that the Messianic era clearly is not as good as the world to come. Even though life will be easier, and it's like a world, in the Rambam's version, what I tell sometimes when I teach this, it's like, imagine, what's the Messianic era in the Rambam's version? It's that you wake up in the morning, you daven, you have your same breakfast, and when you pick up the paper or go online to look at the Jerusalem Post, you're not going to see articles about this political issue or that terrorist attack. You're going to see Dvar Torah of the day, philosophical point of the week. In other words, your whole life will be one always involved in chachma and worship of God. So that's that's the best life on earth. So the Rambam holds the Messianic era is the peak human existence on earth, but it's not the peak human existence. The peak state of human existence is Olam Haba. And he also acknowledges that in the Messianic era, our relationship with God will be the strongest possible that it could be on earth. Okay. So that being the case, okay, the Rambam says, it's pretty clear, the Olam Haba is awesome. Okay, it just does, nothing beats it, okay? So, of course, the question is, if that's true, so why not serve God for the purpose of getting Olam Haba? Why not do the mitzvos? Because you say, I'm going to get the schar of Olam Haba. Right? So he goes back to his point. This is the point he made in the beginning. We should always serve God because it is the correct path. That should be the ultimate motivation, meaning truth is what should guide you, okay? And what happens when we serve God? We perfect our state of existence, right? And that separates us from the animals. And once we really hit what he calls the fully human state, then the idea of the world to come becomes a reality. So what the Rambam is saying is that we should follow the Torah and the mitzvos and everything and learn, etc. Not because we want to get to Olam Haba, but we have to recognize that in doing so, we'll be in a state that merits Olam Haba. We just shouldn't have that be that which motivates us to go into what it called into Olam Haba. And the more perfected we get, the more natural we'll avoid the areas that will take us away from Olam Haba, because we were going to recognize it's a good, and naturally speaking, we're not going to want to be involved in those areas that damage us. Okay. Now the Rambam shifts a bit. He says, there's also another famous part. He says that he really wanted to write a book concerning how to learn Midrashim. If you recall last week, the Rambam spoke about how there are very few people who understand how to learn a Midrash. The Rambam, of course, being one of them. And he explained that you don't take there's some things you do take literally, some things you don't take literally, and recognize there's some idea underneath the surface, and there's a methodology that you need to understand to get that idea out. So he actually wanted to write a sefer on this. He wanted to write a sefer that would guide everybody and how best to study Midrashim. He never wrote it, okay? Or he wrote it and was lost. But we don't have any, there was never a sefer ever printed by the Rambam on Midrashim, which was disappointing because it probably would have been a great sefer. Okay. So now with this being the case, now we're kind of like at the halfway point. Now the Rambam moves into the Yud Gimel Ikar. Okay. He's going to now explain what everyone knows, the 13 fundamentals of Jewish faith. And the Rambam's going to, the best way to describe this, it's an analogy I use often, it's like, in other words, the Rambam felt that there had to be like a minimal, like there's a certain minimal ticket of entrance you require to be part of the religion, okay? Not just simply the biological identity of a Jew, meaning that my mother was Jewish, okay? Rather, there are certain minimal philosophical requirements that the Rambam felt were necessary to be really considered a part of the religion itself, okay? Now, before we get into the Yud Gimel Ikarim, it's important to reflect on that for a second, because I know this is certainly among some modern Orthodox academics today. They're very troubled by this idea. Some question whether this was really authentic. There's so much ink spilled in this area. We could spend hours discussing it. But it's an interesting question in general. Forget historically what happened. It's interesting to think about. Is this something that we consider to be a reasonable objective? For example, if someone denies the existence of God, if someone's an atheist, can they really be considered, philosophically, can they be considered a Jew? Right? If someone denies the Torah, forget divine origin, the Torah itself, can they be considered a Jew? Now, again, this isn't a judgment call. It's just saying, is there an actual threshold? There's an actual minimum standards, minimum shear that exists to say, this person's a Jew. And that's what the Rambam struggled with. And again, there's Machlokasim. Albo has his version. The Rabbagas and stuff. I mean, everyone has a little twist on this. But the point is that it's really a critical thing to think about. Do we consider this to be a reasonable approach? And as we get to the Yud Gimel Ikarim, it's something to reflect on. Okay. You also see, obviously, a tremendous amount of Aristotelian influence in the Rambam's approach to the Yud Gimel Ikarim. So we'll start with that. So what's the first ikar? The first ikar is to believe in the existence of the creator, which sounds pretty easy on the surface, except that the Rambam explains that he's talking about the idea of necessary existence. Now, the Rambam is famous for his use of something called equivocation, where basically what the Rambam will say is that we exist. There's something called, we'll call it regular existence or dependent existence. And then there's something called necessary existence, but recognize that the existence that God is incomparable to what we consider existence to be ourselves. Meaning the very word existence, when applied to God, lacks the means of being an accurate assessment of what God is. Okay? That's a very difficult point. Just to give you Lahavdil as an example, when we praise God in Tefillah, what the Rambam would, like we say, Akela Gadol Gibor Vanora. What the Rambam would say is we're talking about God's Gibor being different than our idea of Gibor. But that very notion itself, the idea of God's Gibor being different, is something we don't really understand. Because what does that mean? We have one understanding of what Gibor is. It doesn't just mean that God's the most Gibor. It's a different idea of Gibor. So that's what he means here also. That God is a necessary existence. And not only that, just give me a second. Right, exactly. And not only that, God is the cause of all existence. Okay, meaning the very idea of existence itself can't be without God. So, and the Rambam says this right in the beginning of the Yesodei Torah as well. That a person has to understand that God is the cause of all existence, and without God, the very idea of existence would be impossible, okay? So the first ikar is to understand God is a necessary existence. Now, when he says creator, I don't think he means creator here, Big Bang creator. I think he means the very idea of existence itself being dependent on God. That is the first ikar, okay? The second ikar is that God is one. This is also a very difficult idea. We're commanded to think about this idea twice a day, right? When we say Shema. And as everyone knows, The halacha by Shema is you're supposed to extend the dalad, not the chet, although it's not bad if you do that, but the dalad. Why? What's the idea of extending it? To give you time to reflect on this extremely challenging philosophical idea. God is one. Now, what does it mean that God is one? Well, it doesn't mean he's not one of something, and he's not numerically one either. As the Rambam puts it, he's uniquely one. And the best example I can give would be something like for instance, let's say, the case for my earbuds, okay? So I can make the argument that there's only one of these in the universe. Now, someone might say, well, what do you mean? There's more of these types of cases. Yeah, but there's no case right now in this point in time and this point in space, right, being held by me. That doesn't exist. So that is uniquely one. That's unique. And even that idea doesn't do justice to the idea of the Rambam's, I assume, of God being one. But the point is that the word I like to use is singular, that God's oneness is a singular oneness and there's nothing like him. So the first ikar is God is necessary existence. And the second one is that God is singular. His existence is one that is singular and there's nothing comparable to it. Okay? Now, as you'll see, the Rambam's building different philosophical ideas about God. The third ikar is that God is not physical. Again, unfortunately, this, for some reason, is considered to be controversial. I don't know why. There's very, very few people who've ever seriously challenged this idea. And I'm not going to get into the reasons why thinking God is physical could be problematic. But basically, the Rambam held that God is not physical. That's an ikar, to believe that God is not physical. So we have necessary existence. God is one and not physical. Now, what the Rambam holds, which some Rishonim argue with, like Kreskes, is that nothing physical, such as his attributes, can be attached to him. Kreskes argued with this point. I'm not getting into that now. But the Rambam held, when we say he's not physical, nothing physical in any way, shape, or form can be attributed to him, can be attached to him, associated with him. God is devoid of physicality as you could ever imagine. Okay, the fourth ikar, the eternity of God. That's an important point, that God's existence is eternal. Now, when we say eternal, we don't even mean like a time idea, because sometimes when people think of eternal, they think that it's like lasting forever, as if that could be an idea in time. No, this is actually outside of time. It means that God is something that's not even bound by time itself. It's an eternal. Like even when we go to Olam Haba, it doesn't mean that my clock still works. It's an eternity. It's outside of time at that point. It just lasts. So God also, his existence is eternal. Okay, so that's the fourth ikar, the fourth philosophical idea about God. And finally, with the fifth ikar, okay, he takes the first four ideas and now points towards something, I'd say, more active. Okay, the first four are really purely abstract thinking ideas that a person must think about God in a certain way. He must believe that God is necessary existence and one, etc. Those are all philosophical concepts about God. They translate into the fifth ikar, which is that we can only worship God. Okay, our worship cannot be addressed to anything else, just to God. Of course, that means not to angels. Okay, you cannot worship an angel. You cannot mispile to an angel. The Rambam would say it's a denial of the ikar. And what I always tell people is that, because I know this is also up for debate, that it's a funny thing. It's a very weird idea that when it comes to halacha, when we have a choice of being machmir or mekel, in general, we always tip towards being machmir, which kind of makes sense in many situations. Not every situation, but I can understand, certainly the suffix deraisa, but I can get that. I get the idea that reflexively we're going to be machmir. Yeah, when it comes to philosophy, right, let's say there's a machlokas. The Rambam holds that it's an ikar, and the identity of a Jew is tied to the idea of exclusive worship of God. And someone else says, no, you can worship an angel. Why wouldn't you be machmir and hold like the Rambam? Because the downside to the Rambam's approach is that if you do daven to angels and it turns out you're denying an ikar, you're losing a chelek olam haba. So I never understood that. I've tried that argument before. It doesn't seem to really... So most people, when I present it to them, they get mortified. But to me, it's a compelling argument. Why not be machmir in this situation? Of course, also, this includes rabbis, okay? We cannot daven to rabbis. You cannot worship rabbis either. The Rambam didn't say that. I'm just including that because sometimes you get the feeling that that the deification of Rabbanim is really evident today in certain streams of Judaism. So can't daven to them either, okay? Worship is only what it called associated with God. And all the Isurim of Avodah Zarah, every prohibition that exists by idolatry is all because of this principle. Okay, so after you've established the positive idea of the four Ikarim and understood that Avodah must always be directed towards God, also know that idolatry is basically, in the Rambam's eyes, no longer the worship of God. It's worship of something else. And that is a denial of the fifth ikar. Okay. Those are the first five ikarim are exclusively about God. Now the problem is that if we stop with the fifth ikar, so then we'd be stuck in a very deistic view, okay? A very deistic perspective, which is that deism means that God created the universe and then went to Starbucks. Has nothing to do with the universe itself. But of course, the Rambam can't say that. Now the Rambam was probably as close to a deist as you can imagine, but he had to maintain, obviously, that there was some communication between God and the universe, that God somewhat is invested in humanity. So he uses prophecy as the stepping stone to this idea. So in the sixth ikkar, you must believe in prophecy, because prophecy means that there's an interaction between God and man. And that's critical, because if there was no idea of interaction between God and man, then you're a deist, right? So prophecy establishes a baseline of God and man being in communication with each other, okay? And that takes care of deism, which leads to the seventh ikkar, okay? Which is that now that prophecy is an idea, the next step is to focus on Moshe's prophecy being unique. This is an idea that Rama mentions both in Yisodei Torah and extensively in the Morei Ruchim. And it's a very, very, very critical part of his approach towards prophecy, which is how Moshe's prophecy stood apart. So again, in the seventh ikkar, which means a fundamental Jewish faith, is that a person must believe that Moshe's prophecy is unique. Now, of course, why? Why is that so important? Well, the reason why is because Moshe was the person responsible for really conveying over the communication between man, between God and man. Meaning Moshe was responsible for bringing over the Torah. So we have to look at Moshe being the Shaliach, right? We have to see his prophecy being different than everyone else's. So in the seventh ikkar, you must see that Moshe's prophecy is unique. And what it called, and he says about Moshe that all his powers of sense and fantasy were oppressed, and all it was pure wisdom and chachma. And actually, there's another book the Rambam was supposed to write that he didn't write, which is that he said that he wanted to write more about this topic, but that he'd keep it for his sefer on prophecy. Another book that actually was never done by the Rambam. Now, when it comes to, and this is, again, one of the Yigami Karim, it's incomplete just to believe that Moshe's prophecy is unique. One's supposed to know, he must know, what are those differences? So the first one is that Moshe spoke directly with God. This one, we're pretty much familiar with all four of these, but that there was never an intermediary, but that God spoke directly to Moshe and vice versa. And that's important, again, because Moshe was responsible for transcribing the Torah, so there had to be no one in between God and Moshe, okay? Moshe was awake and aware of all his prophecies. There was no mechanism. There was no translation required. There was no altering of his senses. He knew exactly what was going on. He was never physically affected. Exactly. He was never physically affected by receiving prophecy. Most prophets underwent like a shaking behavior or that kind of thing, or they were asleep, whatever it might be, when they received prophecy. Now Moshe, it was a completely normal experience for him. And finally, Moshe's prophecy antenna was always up and running, meaning many prophets, okay, would spend their whole life begging for prophecy from God and maybe achieve it once. But by Moshe, literally, he could just tap into it anytime he wanted to. He could just wake up in the morning and say, "Hey, God, what's going on?" And God would answer him. So that shows this link between Moshe and God that was very, very unique. That's the seventh ikkar. Okay, the eighth ikkar, which also has become extremely controversial over the past years, is the divine origin / authorship of the Torah. There's a lot of writing about this. Many people try to de-emphasize the Rambam's focus on this. I'm not going to wade into that topic, but just realize the simple reading of the Rambam is that a person must believe the Torah is divine in origin. Not only that, that the entire Torah was given to Moshe from God, okay? And every word of the Torah is from the divine, and to even suggest, to even have a havamina that Moshe wrote some of the Torah, right? And according to the Rambam, is the pinnacle of heresy, okay? Heresy. So what it called? So that's what the Rambam held, and he's very forceful about it, okay? The Rambam has no interest whatsoever, none, about the idea of anyone else other than Moshe writing the Torah. Now, of course, there's a machlokas in the Gemara who wrote the last eight psukim. Of course, yes, yes, the Rambam was aware of that. He doesn't bring it up here, right? But just saying, in its purest form, the Rambam maintains this was the case, okay? He makes it clear in the eighth ikkar. He doesn't mess around with this. This is a fundamental Jewish faith, okay? Not only that, he held also that the wisdom of the Torah is infinite in depth. So even if the pasuk is Vayidaber Hashem El Shalim Or, that doesn't mean in it there isn't an infinite amount of wisdom that you can mine from that verse. And finally, which the Rambam kind of jams in the end of the eighth ikkar, is to understand that the Torah Shebaal Peh, okay, which, what it called, is evidence, for example, in the building of a sukkah. The sukkah that we have today, according to the Rambam, is the same sukkah that God showed Moshe on Sinai. Okay? When Moshe was up there for 40 days, on day 33, God was up to Hilchos Sukkah, and he, I don't know if it was physical or an image, but he showed Moshe, this is what a sukkah looks like. And that same sukkah that Moshe sat in is the same exact one that we have today. So the Rambam maintains that not only is Torah Shebichtav all from God and is accurate, so too Torah Shebaal Peh. Specifically insofar as things like sukkah and tzitzis and tefillin, there was never a period of time where we're ever unsure of what those things look like. Okay? Okay, the ninth ikar, okay, which is definitely obviously built off the eighth one, is basically the idea that, what do you call it, that the Torah was transcribed directly from God. And therefore, since it came from God, you cannot add or subtract anything from the Torah itself. The Torah is a closed, as we would say in the universe, a causally closed system. It's a closed system. It doesn't lend itself in any way, shape, or form to adjustments. Okay? The tenth ikar is, okay, so now this is a furtherance of the idea that God is invested in humanity, but it's a little bit of a different twist. Again, it's showing you he's not a deist, but from a different perspective. Prophecy is one way. This is another way, which is that God knows all that humanity does. Now, I put that in quotes because when I say he knows, it doesn't mean that it's an ongoing knowledge because God has complete knowledge. Rather, God knows, God knows all that humanity does, okay? Now, that being the case, okay, this is obviously the biggest rejection of deism you can imagine, which leads him to the 11th ikar, which is the idea of divine providence. So the first step is that God has knowledge, meaning God's invested in humanity, right, and its totality, but there's also something called divine providence. Schar v'onesh, the good and evil, okay, that exists as well. Now, what's interesting is that the Rambam does not say, okay, that you need to believe in his version of Olam Haba. He doesn't say that, okay? Rather, he says what a person must believe in is the idea that, what the Rambam wants us to believe in is that in the idea of reward and punishment, the greatest of all rewards is Olam Haba. But he's not denying a person's ability, or I want to use, lack of a better term, right, to say that Olam Haba is the Gan Eden version. He wouldn't say that's you're not denying an ikar if you believe in group 1, 2, 3, or 4 version of Olam Haba. You just have to believe in Schar V'Onesh. And believe that the greatest schar is the Olam Haba. That's what you have to believe in. But he doesn't say you have to believe in his version of Olam Haba. And that's always a point I like to, emphasize. As I put in the end over there. Okay, 12th ikar is the Messianic era. Okay, you must believe in it. The Rambam says, do not set a time for his arrival. It's important not to say he's going to come on January 26th, whatever. A person should never, do that. Nor should you ever speculate on when he will come. It's basically, the Rambam was very against these ideas of speculating about how Tchias Mason works. Same to here. A person should not ask himself and just wonder when Mashiach is going to come. Rather, it should just be a Yisod. And finally, the 13th one is Tchias Mason, which he's already mentioned. He mentioned Tchias Mason previously. Been there, done that. We know already that you must believe in Tchias Mason. So that's the final ikar. And the Rambam has a whole treatise on Tchias Mason itself, where he kind of explains why it's such an important thing for us to believe in. So to finish off, and I saw some people put some questions in the chat, so I'll try to get to those, but to finish off, the Rambam says, when someone believes in these principles, now this person is part of the Jewish people. All right. And again, he's not talking about the halachic identity of a Jew. He's saying that there's a philosophical minimal threshold. And so if a person believes in these, you can call him part of the Jewish nation. And even if a person commits, and this is astonishing, a person commit chet after chet after chet. He could be a serial killer, pedophile, rapist. It doesn't matter. Olam Haba is still possible. However, if you reject one of these 13 principles, you're out. Think about how astonishing that is. Because a person could be more. Look, we tend to look at a person, and when they do something terrible, we isolate that terrible thing and make it their essence. Okay, I'm not saying it's easily forgivable. I'm just saying that's what we do. Right, so if a person's I'm going to say this carefully, I'm not defending serial killers, but if a person's a serial killer, we forget the fact that person also could have been a tremendous Baal Tzedaka, okay? We ignore that, and they're defined by that, essentially. So we don't know how judgment works. We don't know, it could be that person has enough zechuyos that they still get an Olam Haba. But what's amazing is that according to the Rambam, if you reject one of these yesodos, you're out. You are out. You're done. So if you had a choice in front of you, serial killer versus the belief in Moshe's prophecy being unique, better to be the serial killer than to deny the uniqueness of Moshe's prophecy, okay? The other thing also, which is a real real shot at the idea of, and I know someone recently came out with a book about this, and this line here is a powerful argument against what he writes. The Rambam was very against any idea of ever taking the Yud Gimel Karim and putting them in the back of a siddur, or what it called, or making a song out of them, because ultimately, according to the Rambam, these concepts are major philosophical areas. In fact, in the Mor Nevuchim, the Mora takes up basically every one of these Ikarim, right, and just expands on it in remarkable ways. So it's not just enough for a person to read the Yud Gimel Karim, but a person must think about them. You must reflect on them. You must understand them. And through comprehension of the Yud Gimel Karim, so then you're really gaining what the Rambam wants you to gain from. And that's what's going to really make you part of the Jewish nation. Okay, I know, just give me a second. I know some people had some questions on here. Let me see how to bring this up for a second. Chat. Okay, here we go. Just give me a second. Okay, according to Rambam, when you get to Olam Haba, there's no mechanism of improvement. Okay? And I'm not going to get into, I know there's an idea that people think that actions on earth can cause a positive effect on the soul. The Rambam would deny that. He would say instead that if that was going to happen, God would have judged you ready for that. So whatever you do on earth, once you get to Olam Haba, there's no room for improvement. You are who you are. And the other question you had was, if the soul is divine and therefore eternal, coming back as resurrection shouldn't really matter after them anyway. In other words, it shouldn't bother the soul. Well, that's true. That's a good question. I mean, I think the question is that, and I don't know the answer to this, question is, experientially, what does the person experience leaving Olam Haba and going back into earth? I don't know. I'm just saying, if I was an observer, right, I would say, who would ever want to leave Olam Haba and go to earth for Tchias HaMesim? That sounds like a much worse existence. But you're right. It could be that a person would never know such a thing. I don't know. It's an excellent question. I wish I can't know. So, yeah.